The Other Side of the Wind is the
crazy picture. It's not a work of fiction. It's a little of everything. It's kind of a departure in movie making.
Orson Welles was the ultimate independent filmmaker.
Somewhere between Zen master and God.
No other director has been held up to such an impossible standard.
Citizen Kane, the greatest motion picture ever made.
Do you agree?
No, certainly not. That's my next one is, though.
Could you give us the title of that?
I haven't decided what it is yet.
Oh.
Recently that the show, which, by the way, hi, it's called Filmwax Radio. You know, you've been listening to this podcast for some time, and you know that I'm Adam Chartoff, the host of the show. But recently I've been mentioning that I'm bringing on more actors, and so November, December, the coming weeks, you're going to be meeting a lot of actors. And today's episode is no exception. Jeffrey Wright is somebody who has been on my list of actors that I wanted to talk to and bring onto the show, and we finally got him on the show, and it's great. It's not a typical project, and sometimes that's the way that I have to work. I'm, by the way, incredibly proud that this is the film project that he came on with, don't get me wrong, but I had, I guess, envisioned when I get Jeffrey Wright on the show, it'll probably be, you know, with some project, you know, some dramatic film or something like that, you know, who knows. But this is terrific. It's called We Are Not Done Yet, and it's a very important project. It's going to be premiering on HBO today, the 8th of November, 2018, but I just want to sort of set up the show first, and then we'll get back into that specific segment in a minute. Oh, actually, he's on the second segment, so we'll get into that more detail later on. But first is a returning friend of the podcast for his third visit. He's not an actor. He's an author and now a film producer named Josh Karp, referring to the opening trailer that you heard part of. It's called They'll Love Me When I'm Dead. This is Josh's third visit, and I've also had on Peter Bogdanovich, who talked about a little bit about the film. But wouldn't it be great to have brought on Morgan Neville, who's been on the show a few times? Maybe that's something that we'll do. He's the director of They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, which is about the making of The Other Side of the Wind. And both films premiered on Netflix on November 2nd, just days ago. And so this is my first time really getting to the subject of the film, or both films, since that time. So on this episode, we're going to bring back an old friend of the podcast, Josh Karp. So if you do want to hear the past segments with Josh, he was on episodes 301. And 397. So you can go to those episodes on the website, filmwaxradio.com, and search Josh Karp, K-A-R-P, or you can go to our YouTube channel and find those segments there as well. I've even created a playlist on the subject of The Other Side of the Wind, which both of those segments with Josh, as well as this one now, and my conversation with Peter are all in that playlist. And if I can get Morgan back on, which I'm sure I can do, maybe just to discuss his making this documentary, They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, you know, I'll add that as well. In the meantime, though, this episode 519, we're lucky to have Josh back on the show. He's a sweet guy. I love the book he wrote, which is all about the long, epic story trying to get Orson Welles' last film, The Other Side of the Wind, to the screen, even though there was legal aspects, for sure, to the story. You know, it's like one of those cases where you know, if you throw enough money at something, especially when it has legal issues, it gets fixed. You just got to pay off lots of people, and you got to pay for people to come in on the technical side and edit it and produce it and fix it and finish it, all these things. And that you know, that's where Peter Bogdanovich comes in, and Frank Marshall and a few other people who were capable of making Orson's vision happen to as great a degree as they could with the material they had, right? Since Orson Welles died in 1985. Josh, his three visits now sort of take place over the course of the story. As I mentioned in this upcoming conversation with him, the first time he was on, it was because I read this book he wrote called Orson Welles' Last Movie, The Making of The Other Side of the Wind. The first time we just kind of talked about the book, and then the next time he came on, Netflix had come through. So we talked about that. And then this time now, the movie has, of course, premiered on Netflix, and also the documentary that we've been talking about is also on Netflix. It relies heavily on Josh's book, and Josh was made a producer on the documentary, on Morgan's documentary. They'll Love Me When I'm Dead tells the story of legendary director Orson Welles at the end of his career. He was no longer the wonder boy, flush with success from Citizen Kane, but an aging artist in exile whose luck had run out. The Other Side of the Wind was the feature film meant to be his Hollywood comeback vehicle. And for over 6 years, he struggled to complete it, filming whenever he could make enough money from acting gigs and commercial appearances. In 1985, it all ended. The film remained unfinished upon his death and stayed locked in a vault for almost four decades. Comprised of never-before-seen footage from Welles and original interviews with cast and crew, the documentary, like Orson's work, is a dense story of betrayal made up of many fragments of high and low culture. The film, again, is directed by Morgan Neville, produced by Coraline Madison and Josh Karp, and executive produced by Frank Marshall and Philip Rimsha. Now, I probably butchered that last name, so I apologize. Regardless, this is Josh Karp here, back on Filmwax Radio.
The Other Side of the Wind, what is that?
Orson Welles' last movie.
Everything else I've ever done has been controlled, but I want to go further.
It's a story of the last day of the director's life.
The darling of Hollywood, who fell out of favor.
Wait a minute, that's Orson. Is it? Orson, is that you?
Everybody will think it's autobiographical, but it's not.
Yeah, bullshit.
Orson was such a perfectionist.
Action!
So I think we have ourselves a confrontation.
Cut.
I fucked that up.
Take 21.
He was creating an environment where others would get sucked into it.
It was this circus of scattered souls.
It's Orson, it'll be something.
We were totally out of reality.
And he said, if anything ever happens to me, I want you to promise me you'll finish the picture.
I'm going to probably like edit it so we're starting now, actually. Josh Karp, okay. Author and producer, that we were discussing character actors because I'm getting a bunch on my podcast. And one is Jeffrey Wright. And you mentioned the words, literally you said, whatever he's in, he's the best thing in it. And
absolutely.
And that is the name of a documentary. The best.
Really?
I think it's either called He's the Best Thing in It, or it's, or just The Best Thing in It. I can't remember. But it's a documentary about character actors. It's not a very especially slick documentary, you know,
uh-huh.
But it was entertaining because they interview all of these recognizable guys, like the classic, I know that guy, but I just can't remember his name. You know, those faces that are in dozens of movies as supporting characters. And while Jeffrey Wright is more than a supporting character,
right.
Typically, you know, it's funny you use the same phrase. He's the best thing in it. It's check it out. It is a film. It might be on Netflix. I don't remember where I saw it.
Oh, totally. You know, in fact, what's his name? Peter Jason. I don't know. You'd recognize him if you Googled him in a
sure,
second. He's
right.
Actually in The Other Side of the Wind, and he's absolutely one of those people. He's the guy who you're like, oh, I love it when that guy.
Yeah.
Is in that,
yeah.
You know, but you would never know his name in a million years unless you just see him, you know,
sure.
See him up.
And I'm pretty good with, like, you know, over the years, obviously, given how many films I watch and, you know, and the way I approach them, I do know a lot of these guys' names, but you know, there are just so many of them that I have no idea. Like, you know, I did not know that name, but I'm sure, again, you're right, I would know the face. You know?
He is the, as I explained to my wife, I was like, he's the racist bartender in 48 Hours.
Oh, or whatever, yeah, that sure.
He's the guy who Eddie Murphy gets in the argument with, you know, and throws the shot glass through the window or whatever.
Yep.
But yeah, no, Peter's in everything, and he's fantastic.
When I saw 48 Hours in the movie theater as a kid with my friend, my camp friend, we went to Times Square. You know, this is in the grittier days of Times Square, and we were right in the theater watching 48 Hours, which is all about, like, you know, cops and chasing thugs and all, and through New York City, right? It takes place in New York City, right?
No, it's in San Francisco.
Oh, it's in San Francisco. So, oh well. But anyhow, when we came out of the theater, literally, cops were chasing, like plainclothes cops were chasing after somebody, like running down Broadway with their guns up. Like that happened, you know.
Right, so you're getting a live reenactment.
Exactly. It was fun. Right. You brought up The Other Side of the Wind?
Yeah.
So it's a good place to pop into that conversation. So I was calling you because we should have talked a while ago, but I imagine you were probably a little busier leading up to the premieres, I don't know, of both The Other Side of the Wind, but also The Love Me When I'm Dead, which is the making of documentary directed by Morgan Neville,
yeah,
which are now both available right this minute on Netflix.
Yes,
so,
as of Friday.
Yeah. So I got to see, just so you know, I got to see The Other Side of the Wind finally, at the New York Film Festival in Alice Tully Hall. That was exciting.
I was there for both. Did you see the documentary too?
No, I tried to go. I didn't work fast enough to get on the list. You know, I mean, there are several ways of my being able to get in if I had acted a little sooner.
Right.
But I got into the second screening, public screening. I wanted to get into the first one for obvious reasons. It worked out fine. I mean, if everything had worked out and I had acted a little earlier, I would have been able to see both of those films back to back, as you know. And with everybody there, I'm sure it would have been a lot more exciting. But what can you do?
Right.
It worked out pretty well. I got Peter Bogdanovich on the show after all.
Oh, cool. That's great.
Yeah, and then I get Josh Karp back, so that's nice, too.
No, not quite Peter Bogdanovich, but...
I'm happy about it. So I had to watch The Love Me When I'm Dead, like everybody else, on Netflix.
Okay.
But I really enjoyed it. And you are a producer on it.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
It was a great, unbelievable experience. It was really fun, kind of... being able to go through the story again and then see it, you know, kind of as through Morgan's eyes, you know, have somebody else who, you know, is incredibly talented take, you know, kind of the bones of something that I had worked on,
right,
and, you know, then see it on the screen and see it through the way he did it, which I thought was unbelievable.
And the bones you're talking about is your book, which we've talked about a couple of times on the show, but it's called Orson Welles's Last Movie, The Making of The Other Side of the Wind. So the movie, the documentary rather, is largely using your book
as source material. We went and redid, you know, all the interviews and, you know, and then Morgan used an unbelievable amount of archival footage from both the actual film, The Other Side of the Wind, including stuff that never makes it into the film.
Mm-hmm.
And then from Orson's life and career, particularly, you know, the last 15 years, you know, 70 to 85.
Right. So, because what happened was, you and I talked the first time in 2015, if you can believe it.
Yeah, right.
And I think that things were still kind of up in the air as far as the final funds for The Other Side of the Wind. Wasn't sure. It was still in limbo. And then, in a kind of serendipitous turn of events, Netflix swooped in and ended up dropping all the necessary funds, so able to kind of get the film out of its legal and its financial slump.
Right. Yeah.
And then when that happened, I think we got back on the phone, you and I, briefly to talk about that.
Right. Yeah.
That was probably, I don't know, 2017. So they then could provide all that footage not used in the final edit, right, for the documentary as well. So there was extra footage there that you were able to access.
Yeah, there were, I mean, I can't remember how many hours of footage, but whatever it was, he shot way more, considerably more than the average ratio, you know, a filmmaker shoots. Mm-hmm. When you shoot a movie for 6 years, you tend to get a lot of extra footage, which was great for us. So we had footage of both Rich Little and Peter Bogdanovich playing the same part.
Explain that. Explain what this little bit of the background about that is.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think I've always found this to be the most telling thing about the film is that, you know, Welles was making this film that was about a director coming back from exile in Europe who is trying to make an innovative comeback movie that he's having trouble getting funds for, which is exactly what Welles himself is doing, right? And it's an aging director who winds up being played by John Huston. And so Welles, you know, the film was he denied that it was autobiographical, but of course it was highly autobiographical. And one of the things he did was the film kind of evolved in real time. He was rewriting the script in this kind of art imitating life manner,
mm-hmm.
based on events in his actual life. And so what happened was in 1970, when he starts, he has Joe McBride and Bogdanovich, who at the time are both writers. Bogdanovich in particular is just, you know, he's not really a big director yet,
mm-hmm.
Playing guys who are writing biography character. He hires John Huston in sometime about like 1974 to play the lead, and hires Rich Little, of all people, you know, famous comedic impressionist, to play a character who is a young director who has made three incredibly successful movies in a row, who is a protege of the main character. And this is absolutely who Bogdanovich was at the time. And when Rich Little...
I think, by the way, Orson had guest appeared on the Copycats show, which was how he met Rich Little. And probably just because Orson Welles happens to be Orson Welles...
He
thought, I'm going to cast this guy in an unlikely... Like, back then, that wasn't done as nearly as frequently. Nowadays, it's very de rigueur, like, you know, inspired casting choices.
Right.
But back then, back then, it would not have been usual to have some impersonator or, you know, impressionist to play a lead actor in a movie.
Right. Well, and Bogdanovich was famous for going on The Tonight Show and doing celebrity impressions. So
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, so this was kind of a direct, you know, parody of Bogdanovich.
Oh, right, he did do that. That's right. That's right.
Yeah, he did a great Jerry Lewis, but he did Cary Grant. He did all kinds of stuff. And so when Rich Little winds up kind of leaving the film under mysterious circumstances, and they have to junk all this footage with him in this role, Welles talks to Bogdanovich, and Bogdanovich says, hey, why don't I take over the part? And Welles says, well, you know, what about the stuff you shot before? And he goes, oh, just cut that out. You can reshoot that. That's not much. And so Bogdanovich literally goes from playing who he is in 1970 to playing who he is in 1974. Now he is the guy who's made Last Picture Show,
Paper Moon, right.
And What's Up, Doc.
Right.
And this is all kind of never spoken to. And he's, in a lot of ways, really playing out his relationship with Welles under both circumstances. So I always think that, to me, if you had to summarize the story of the movie, it's that Bogdanovich goes from playing exactly who he is in relation to Welles in 70, and then becomes a new character in 74 who is now who he is, playing out his relationship with
Welles. That's right. If that weren't enough, I'm actually reading those interviews. Finally, I'm kind of catching up to the interviews, Bogdanovich's interviews with Orson.
Yeah.
I'm finally reading that. So I'm getting a lot of the details about, right now, I'm at that point now where they're talking about The Other Side of the Wind.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, they had an unbelievably, you know, like, cinematic relationship. I mean, their story is like a Greek tragedy or a Shakespearean story or you know,
yeah, so a little bit of Chimes of Midnight come in there too, because with Falstaffian kind of a moment there where kind of really digs the dagger into Bogdanovich. I don't know. Do you think you show the clip on the Tonight Show where Burt Reynolds, who's cast in several at least two anyway, Bogdanovich films, is guest hosting for Johnny Carson. And, you know, Orson Welles is a guest. And they really speak rather maliciously about, they humiliate Bogdanovich, who's not there, mind you. But the,
yeah, at a time when Welles either is still living in Bogdanovich's house.
Oh, yeah.
Or, he's like a permaguest. Yeah, no, he was like the man who came to dinner. I mean, he moved in there in 75 and lived there, you know, for a couple of weeks.
Why?
He made a lot of money, but he spent never more of it. Had it.
No, right.
You know, I mean, he made a staggering amount of money when he worked. And
okay.
But he just couldn't, and it wasn't like he was spending it on anything.
Well, he did say how he cut down on his cigars at one point to raise money for The Other Side of the Wind, which I think was really funny. That's funny.
Well, the guy was, he had handmade, like, custom made for him cigars.
Hand rolled. Yeah, right. No, I figured that.
About like 20 bucks a piece, and he was putting away about 25 of them a day. So that was like, you know, you're smoking like $500 of cigars a day.
It's cheaper to have a heroin habit.
It is.
That's funny. By the way, because of Bogdanovich was at the height of his directorial success, he had a rather large house with the Orson Welles had his own wing, I believe. But he was like the man who came to dinner. You're right.
Yeah, I mean, anyway, it was it's kind of a great, would be a great, you know, sitcom is Orson, Sybil Shepherd, and Peter living in this house with Orson kind of taking over the whole place and getting, you know, freaked out because they're out of fudgesicles. I always loved that he used to accuse them of eating all the fudgesicles.
Orson Welles was a deeply oral fixated guy.
For sure.
I mean, obviously his appetite, but...
The cigars.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the fudgesicles,
Sometimes a fudgesicle is just a fudgesicle. That's what I'm going to say.
And sometimes a fudgesicle is just a cigar.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Anyway, so where were we? Keep getting...
We were talking about Orson and Peter's relationship.
Yeah.
Orson,
oh, right. So the Tonight Show.
Kind of crapping all over Peter.
Can you want to finish the Tonight Show anecdote where they just turn the screws on him a little bit?
Yeah, and you know, and it's funny because I mean, as you know, both in working on the book and on the film, you know, they had this bizarre relationship, but I really always kind of, as time went on, just struck home for me how much Peter really gave to Orson at a time when Peter is on top of the world. And, you know, Orson kind of, you know, Orson was very, I mean, people were happy to let Orson kind of invade their lives because he was Orson.
He was great
to be around. He was magnetic, he was charming, but Peter really gave and gave and gave to Orson, and I don't think I understood that when I went into the project. I always kind of, you know, viewed it a little bit the other way around before I really understood. And I think Peter really, you know, in an almost heroic way, gave to Orson and had patience for him. And I mean, he shot in Peter's house while he was living there for, you know, quite a while.
The Other Side of the Wind, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. The Love Me When I'm Dead, which stands on its own, I have to say, as an entertaining documentary about Hollywood, about Orson Welles, about Peter Bogdanovich, who has participated, contemporarily speaking, in this documentary, which is, yes, a making of the Other Side of the Wind documentary, but again, it does stand up on its own as an entertaining documentary. There's just so much I had learned that I did not know. I'm botching this up, but Bogdanovich's house was next door to...
Oh, no, so you're thinking of the house in Arizona.
Oh, is it Arizona? I'm screwing up.
Yeah, so he was kind of in residence at Peter's house in Bel Air for quite a while, but before that, in 1974, they shot in Carefree, Arizona. And the film, there's a film within the film that this filmmaker is making. And it's kind of makes fun of atmospheric European cinema.
That's
of the day.
That's Antonioni,
located literally next door to the house that Antonioni blew up in Zabriskie Point.
That's right. That's what I was. That was in Arizona. I see. I got that mixed up. Okay. Very good. Yeah. So just I just want for those listening to understand. So on that Johnny Carson episode, they just kind of made fun of the success or lack of a, I guess one of the films that was after what's
Nickelodeon
yeah. was kind of a flop and starred Burt Reynolds. But Burt Reynolds, you come to know that he's such a huge star. One little flop isn't going to really be a big deal to him.
Right.
But it had to hurt Peter Bogdanovich's feelings. So Peter Bogdanovich is watching this from home, this Tonight Show episode, and, you know, writes Orson, lets him know that you know, I guess I know how you feel about me. Because they were really making fun of of him and of this failure of the film. And Orson sends two letters, right? It's just another level of cruelty.
Yeah, you know, he sends him two letters. And one is this heart, you know, pouring out his heart, apologizing to Peter and saying how horrified at how cruel he's been to him on television. And, you know, that he will never forgive himself for being so cruel to somebody who's been such a good friend and so supportive. And then the other letter says, you deserved it. And Orson tells him to take his pick, which is just an unbelievable, you know, story of, you know, I mean, it's very cruel. Although if you depersonalize it, I guess you wind up writing it off to the kind of what somebody who lives that kind of life begins to view the world like, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that makes sense, but, you know, when you're somebody whose personality is so outsized, I guess, you know, you feel entitled to do those kind of things. But yeah, I mean, I think it hurt Peter extremely.
Yeah, it took a while for them to reconcile, and even then, I don't think it was ever quite healed up.
But he was really a true believer in Orson.
Yeah,
you know, and then, you know, had this, you know, had a career downturn that, in many ways, I think, you know, didn't directly mirror Orson's, but he went through a lot of the same problems Orson did, which.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, maybe, yeah. He, you know, it's interesting. I mean, my thought about that is, if it's worth anything, is that Peter was stuck in an age that was sort of outdated. His aesthetic, his inspiration, you know, and Hollywood is different. You know, I think Peter would have thrived making all those films that he was wanted to make years earlier, but it just wasn't in step anymore on some level.
Right.
But he had this one story he wanted to keep telling about. Mm-hmm. This frozen moment in time, you know, but there's no denying he's brilliant. I think, you know, is it too simple to say that Orson was fine as long as the power dynamic was in his favor? You know, it had to be humiliating to be leaning on Peter. So he maybe felt just ambivalent about that and, you know, passive aggressively let Peter know that, you know, he wasn't happy with that dynamic.
Yeah,
it was great as long as he was in the charge of that dynamic, you know.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, I think, yeah. And I think that's probably a difficult change for anybody to experience.
Sure, it is.
But when you're, you know, when you're Orson Welles, you know, and you've had somebody who's been just worshipful of you and who's done all this stuff for you, you know, to have this dynamic change and really be surpassed, at least in commercial success.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Orson always had Citizen Kane, which he claimed was his curse, but was also the ace in the back pocket where everybody always, you know, could say, well, the guy did make the greatest movie ever made.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think he could not deal with that shift in the power dynamic. And it was interesting because then, you know, he had all these power, you know, relationships where he and John Huston were equals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, under this scenario, and they're together. And then Gary Graver, his cinematographer, is kind of in this position where he's like an indentured servant to Orson, who comes whenever called, who gives up his whole life happily.
Right.
Orson.
Your book, which again was called Orson Welles' Last Movie, and this documentary really pay, I think, an appropriate due to Gary Graver. You give him his due. It's great to see it. You know, if there's ever any question or that about Gary's place in the story and what he sacrificed, you know, you've given him, I think, finally a fair amount of attention in that way, you know, that he deserved.
It's really, I mean, it's almost inconceivable to think of another relationship
like
that in Hollywood. I mean, somebody who, you know, I mean, I don't know what Gary would have become had he not worked for Orson, but he he gave everything to this movie and to Orson, and would have done it again.
Yeah, and he was really, really distraught when Orson Welles died.
Yeah, that's one of the saddest things in the film, I thought, is listening to him talk about how, actually listening to Peter Jason, the actor we were talking about, he tells the story of how Gary said to him, you know, I don't know what to do. Every day I wake up and I call Orson, or Orson calls me, and he tells me what to do that day. And now I don't know what to do because Orson is gone. And that's just such a heartbreaking,
yeah,
you know, story.
Amazing. Well, in an awkward shift, you have tied your, you've kind of tied yourself to this story for at least, I'm going to guess, 5 years, maybe longer.
Longer, yeah.
Yeah, 6-7 years at least. It's, the story's over. I mean, this chapter. Maybe the book on this is shut because you know, it's on Netflix. Hopefully millions of people will see the movie, you know, make of it what it, I tell people, you know, go see it with a very open mind and don't expect anything. Just take it in and appreciate it for what it is. It's the, you know, it's visually a feast, you know, there's no denying it. And it is a fun thing to watch, but it is also like Orson Welles' appetite right there in front of you.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's funny. Earlier this fall, I wrote an article about Dennis Hopper's film The Last Movie for Esquire, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And which was his kind of mini version of The Other Side of the Wind,
yep.
Kind of his, you know, epic, you know, never-ending...
Right, overly ambitious, right.
Make a perfect film.
Right.
And make a piece of art. And one of the things that happened when the film was coming out, there were all these interviews where Hopper said stuff like, you know, I know this is a lot to ask, but I think people will really understand it if they watch it 3 or 4 times. And you don't need to watch Other Side of the Wind 3 or 4 times, but what is interesting is I think, you know, judging by people, friends of mine, and like my brother-in-law is a really good example, you know, they really found it fascinating and then, you know, saw it again.
Mm-hmm.
And found new stuff. And
right.
I think that's what's cool about Welles is that Welles really... Every movie he makes can be about everything. Do you know? And I don't mean that in a diffuse way. You know, people take so many different things away from his work and different things away from it at different times and at different viewings.
Sure.
And the idea, you know, that he, like his daughter Beatrice said, you know, every frame for him was like a canvas and an individual work of art.
Sure.
And so, you know, that's one of the things that's really fascinating about watching the film.
So I guess what I was going to start to say before was, what are you going to do now? I mean, you wrote this article about the last movie, but are you ready to, you know, move on yourself? It was such a big story for so many years.
Yeah, no, you know, it's funny. I mean, I'm working on a book proposal for about a non-film subject, and I have, TV pilot that I wrote that got optioned and that's being shopped. But what's funny is I keep thinking, God, I wish there were another movie like this to write about. And in a way, it you know, hopefully that will emerge again someday. But
yeah,
you know, really this story, you know, as far as the making of a movie and writing about big characters in Hollywood, you know, there is a little bit of kind of like, yeah, you know, like that's, wow, okay, finally, you know,
yeah,
I'm not writing about John Huston and Orson Welles anymore, which was such a great opportunity.
Yeah.
You know, you just, because the world doesn't make those guys anymore.
Right.
So there's, you know, so I'm doing a bunch of other stuff and have other projects moving forwards, but there's, you know, a little bit of, you know, loss, I think, in this all coming to a happy conclusion.
Yeah.
In that, you know, it's, you know, it's like, you know, writing about these epic figures and this crazy once in a lifetime story.
Right. Well, again, the documentary is called The Love Me When I'm Dead, which is a quote that, again, getting back to Orson and Peter's relationship, but Orson, you know, understood how people's inclination is to mythologize and to repaint memory. You know, when someone passes away, all of a sudden we start to create a new memory of who they were. And I think Orson understood that for all the complexities of how people felt about him, that and his work, right?
Right.
That after he dies, they were going to embrace him.
And he was right.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, yeah. And it's only, you know, grown. I mean, you know, it's as far as a filmmaker, nobody sits there and goes, oh, you know, what about those movies he didn't do this to? Or what about, you know, Don Quixote? Or what about that? The average person who knows him as a filmmaker thinks, oh, my God, that's the guy who made Citizen Kane.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm grateful for the fact that I got to read the book, your book, and you know, and get caught up myself in the, yeah, and get caught up in the whole story, and get to know you and talk to you a few times, and glad to have had you on the podcast, and you know, it's a place, you know, I'd be proud to have you back on any time for a future projects.
I'm happy to come back anytime.
And so you can talk about even if, and if your book, your new book, does get indeed optioned and published, please do. Come back on, even if it's not a film subject. Doesn't matter. You can talk about anything you want.
You got it. You got it. Thanks,
Adam. All right. Have a great day.
Okay, you too. Take care.
All right, talk to you soon.
All right, bye.
No story has a happy ending unless you stop telling it before it's over.
Let us raise our cups to our crazy and beloved profession, to the movies.
A lot of people want to see The Other Side of the Wind get made.
It is the greatest movie never released, the bookend to Citizen Kane.
What did Orson really mean by it? What is its true form?
Orson said, they'll love me when I'm dead.
Since 2001, 2.75 million U.S. service members have been deployed to support American war efforts. Approximately 14 to 20% of veterans who engaged in conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan experienced PTSD, while 32.4% of female veterans report having experienced military sexual trauma. We Are Not Done Yet profiles a group of veterans and active duty service members as they come together to combat past and current traumas through the written word, sharing their experiences in United States organizations, in a United Service Organizations USO writing workshop at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center. Directed by Serene Haribidian and produced by actor Jeffrey Wright and David Holbrook, this powerful short film has its debut again tonight, Thursday, November 8th at 8 o'clock Eastern Time in conjunction with Veterans Day, exclusively on HBO. The documentary will also be available, of course, on HBO On Demand, HBO Now, HBO Go, and partners streaming platforms. It's a great honor, and I might add a lot of fun to bring on the actor Jeffrey Wright here on Film Wax Radio.
I don't want people to view me as, oh, there's that crazy vet.
PTSD was a term that I never liked hearing.
There's all these things that people deal with in between, like bullets and Band-Aids.
We have a group of veterans and active duty service members that gather regularly and decided to write a collaborative poem and turn it into a performance.
I'm just me, a woman, a writer, a survivor.
And it allowed us to really reach across the spectrum of trauma as a whole.
I remember the first time that I performed on a stage, and I'm telling you,
these hands have saved and given life,
loved and killed. Have caused pain.
A service member will be acknowledged, will applaud. The other side that needs to be placed on a stage are the stories of the effect of war on human beings who take up the call.
We are going to be heard probably for the first time, because I know that a lot of us have not been heard.
This poem is not a cry for help.
This poem is not my broken pieces.
You're not done yet.
Yeah,
Strom Thurmond used to say. Do you remember that?
I tried not to soak in as much as you know, very much of what Strom Thurmond used to say.
That was during the Anita Hill thing. Professor Hill, can you talk into the machine?
Can you talk? I can't hear it. Can you
talk? The machine. Yeah. It was all just machines.
Yeah.
If it didn't have blood.
Yeah.
I'm gonna just listen to you. Just say something.
Testing.
Yeah, that sounds good. Okay.
1, 2.
Running around a lot?
Yes.
I thought I had an opening, like some sort of soliloquy? Opening remarks. Not a soliloquy exactly, but no, it's a thrill because, you know, the idea behind this is to kind of talk about independent film, art film, and films that don't get quite as much, you know, usually attention. And certainly documentaries fall under that category as well. They usually can use as much help as they can get. So just hold that up. To hear, they're not as dynamic as
They seem.
Yeah, as they seem. Oh, so you know, this is what I was going to say. Actually, since you brought up Senator Thurman, is this is a nice day to meet. It turns out could have gone a very different way, but yeah. I feel I'm in a good mood today.
Wasn't the greatest day, but it's but it's a better day than the day before.
Right, and a better day than it could have been if it went.
Oh yes,
you know, south on us.
It looked a little wonky there at the start.
Well, that's the problem. You can never really in this day and age rely on the predictions, polls, and all that.
Yeah, but that Florida, Georgia governor's race were weird. And the Senate race, it was the Senate race in Florida even more so than I think disappointing too, because just the whole balance shifted more so than we would like. I would think. In the opposite direction in the Senate. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
These are dark days. Let's make no mistake.
Yeah.
It's just that maybe there's a slightly little less darkness today.
And there's a little bit of accountability.
Yeah. Right.
Exactly. A lot of accountability, actually.
Exactly. So it would have been kind of like challenging to meet today, but I would have still looked forward to it. Yeah. I'm just glad.
Cool.
Well, I think we're talking about game night, aren't we? No, that's not right. I'm sorry. My notes. Sorry, that was the wrong notes.
Yeah, we could.
Well, it's funny because I did make a note. That's quite a striking difference in between those two films that you're more. Maybe these are your two most recent projects, but more or less anyway, right? But that's I guess what you do. Right?
Yeah,
you know, that's what.
Well, I shot a film called OG.
Oh right.
After finishing Westworld in 2016.
Uh huh.
I think we finished in like April, something like April, May. Then I went to do OG, uh-huh. which we shot in a maximum security prison out in Indiana, largely with incarcerated men in the cast. Then I went to do another film, a film called Monster here in New York. And that was like late summer, early fall. Then I started working on this not on the film, but on the theatrical event that we put on with the vets.
Yeah, Theater of War?
No. We're not done yet.
No, right. Okay, I'm getting a little confused. The what we see at the end of the
right, the, that process started then.
Right.
And then I went, took a little bit of a break, then went to do Emilio Estevez movie, The Public, then went to do Hold the Dark. That was like February, April. And then after that, I did Game Night, which was kind of a little bit of a respite from all of this stuff, which was a little heavier. But actually, it was more stressful. Doing Game Night was more stressful than doing this stuff.
Because
dying is easy, comedy is hard, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, that is remarkable, that kind of schedule.
Well, you got to do what you got to do.
I guess so. The documentary short, which we're here to talk about today, we're at the office of HBO, is called We Are Not Done Yet, and it is a passion project of yours, I guess, right? Where you've gotten a group of veterans together who are suffering from PTSD or some sort of psychological harm from either their time served or since, and it's about the catharsis that they're experiencing, right, with this poetry project. I don't know how well I described it. Maybe you do better.
Well, they're a group of 10 veterans who use the written word as a means of confronting and processing trauma and as a means of healing themselves and healing one another. They work down in arts therapy workshops led by a poet named Seema Reza, who works mm-hmm. out of Walter Reed Military Hospital outside of D.C. and also Fort Belvoir. And these were kind of the elite unit, if you will, of the writers that she worked with. And one of them had an idea that it would be additive to the healing process if they did these poems in public, if they did a stage reading of a collective poem that they had written together. And long story short, I came down, how I came down, came to this, but I came down and helped direct them through this process. And the documentary is born out of that.
Were you familiar with Sima's poetry, with her this project at Walter Reed beforehand? How did you initially connect with her or with this with the group?
Well, I had started doing a group of I had started working with a group called Theater of War that does readings of the Greek tragedies as a means of inspiring conversation around PTSD.
I'm rude. I just got to insert one little thing and then I'll get...
Yeah.
I was at a Theater of War event this weekend.
Oh, wow.
Coincidentally, in Brooklyn.
Oh, wow.
Around Antigone.
Yeah.
In Antigone in
But around
Ferguson.
Gun violence, right?
Yes.
I was supposed to do that one, but I had to be in D.C., so Brian, rings me up. Brian Dury rings me up every once in a while and says, "Well, will you come do this reading?" And I say, "I either can or I can't."
Right.
So we do. He does these in military communities, but also in inner cities as examination of the consequences of war and also the consequences of gun violence on local communities. And his argument is that from a military perspective, that the Greeks were a warrior society who chronicled war, the challenges and the victories through these works, and that they took on these stories as a collective in the amphitheater in Athens. And not only did they take on the upside, the celebratory side of war, if there is one, I suppose there can be, but they also took on the consequences of war. For example, I read Ajax, whose story regards him returning home from battle and having this, what might be described as a psychotic fit and killing everyone, within arm's reach. And Brian's argument is that that's an examination of PTSD. But his further argument is, and the argument that I derive from it, is that we don't do that in American society. We don't take on these stories of the consequences as a collective. Rather, we kind of we talk about war and the troops and the vets in platitudes, and we flash, the kind of superficial, symbols of patriotism at them, but we don't really listen to them. And even at, something like the Presidential Medal of Honor ceremony, which is always, I'm always moved by hearing those stories of those veterans and what they did, their acts of valor, whether they're there or whether it's posthumously, read posthumously. But even in those settings, we don't hear from the veteran. They don't speak. Somebody else reads the citation, and the president, or in our case, the guy who's in there now, hands them the medal, and they move on. So, but we rarely hear firsthand about the complexities of war, about the injury that war inflicts on the human psyche, as well as on the body. And so I did one of these readings, one of these theater of war readings down in D.C., and there were some representatives from the Pentagon there. And I just happened to ask if there's anything else that comes up that I might be able to, lend a hand to, would you let me know? Somehow I passed the vetting process with the Department of Defense. And a few weeks later, a couple months later, they called me up and said there's a poet named Sima Reza. She works with a group of veterans, and one of them wants to do a play. Will you come down and direct them?
Yeah.
And I said, yeah.
Yeah.
And I came down, put my theater experience in my backpack. and brought it to bear with them. And it was in the end, it was a great privilege. It was one of the great privileges of my career.
Wow. I can understand that. You see, like, an immediacy to how I mentioned the word catharsis earlier, but you can actually see it unfolding in front of you. I can imagine, and participating in that could be very rewarding, you know. And they're on, some of them, I guess, are experiencing some level of healing through this process, right? That's the hopes, anyway. There's a moment in there, I remember, where you're directing them, like, yeah, that's not working. Whatever, you know, you need to, you treated them like you would probably if you were directing any actors. Is that, or can you say that?
Well,
or, I mean,
I treated them, yes, as collaborators, okay. But obviously, it was a very delicate space. And, I don't think SEMA would have allowed me into the room if it didn't seem that I was aware of that. So I treated them as collaborators, but they, you know, you like in any situation that you find yourself in working in this way, you have to be able to adapt.
Yeah.
And I think I had to really crank up my empathetic antenna on this.
Right.
And but at the same time, they were so powerful as artists, uh-huh. and so respectful and celebrating of this opportunity, and they were so committed to it, and clearly they really wanted to do this. They needed it. I think, you know, one of the things that the film highlights, particularly at a time in which we are cynical about this, is the importance and the real value of art. This for them is not a frivolous exercise. It's not an indulgence, and they're not just playing make believe. That wasn't their desire on that stage. Their desire was to use this as a tool in a real objective way toward healing themselves and healing one another. And so they took it seriously. They speak about art in life and death terms. You know, it's no bullshit.
Yeah.
So they wanted to work, and I was more than happy to be there helping them through it.
And you yourself also had to learn from them, right, about how they were presenting themselves as soldiers,
yeah,
or as veterans, right?
Yeah, that was the thing that was really impactful for me, is to understand that even though there is a sense that they've been betrayed, perhaps
by
these institutions,
yeah.
At the same time, they honor what they did. They served, as A.B. describes, with duty, honor, respect, and that they were fully committed. And I think that makes the betrayal that much harder. And so, yes, you know, there's a process. Like any process, you have to problem solve when you're working on a scene. And they made it plain to me, particularly one of them, Bobby Plagman, made it plain to me that, you know, the direction that I was giving them was not necessarily the most effective and needed to be much clearer. And I love that moment that Serene captured that, because
yes.
Serene Haribedian is our director, and she was kind of quietly in the corner filming what was happening with another cameraman, or one or two on occasion. And Serene was invited by Seema Reza because she wanted to bear witness. Seema wanted to capture this as mm-hmm. a kind of bearing witness to what we were doing, and also perhaps put a short film together to market the work, and perhaps maybe to fundraise too. But it wasn't the intent to do this documentary. So we weren't really paying attention to what Serene was doing. We were just working on our project. And so she very kind of unobtrusively captured
right. what
we did. And I was so glad that she captured that moment. She captured everything, obviously. But we put that moment in the film because it highlights the ways in which, how seriously they take their training mm-hmm. and their service. It highlights, too, the ways in which they have been shaped by that training. And it also showed a trajectory toward trust Between all of us, and it just showed it was a wonderful starting point and a kind of touchstone for the evolution of the process of making the film, putting on that theatrical piece that the film highlights.
Yeah, these guys really put themselves out there at the end of the day, because not only were they making themselves, they were in the most vulnerable place possible, putting their emotional lives out there in the terms of the writing, the poetry or the writing, the prose, as well as the performance of it. But then there is a documentary on top of that, which so it adds a whole other, you know, dimension to it. And it's, you know, most documentaries get to be seen by, you know, hopefully several thousand, maybe tens of thousands of people. But on HBO, it's a much bigger audience. So, you know, these guys are really, but maybe it'll feel very, at the end, very gratifying that their stories are out there and more people will see them.
Well, I think one thing to remember is that the film is only a snapshot of who they are. And what they've described to me that's I find pretty interesting is that they can look at the film now and see where they were. So even within the film, you can see a progress toward healing for them. But that was 2 years ago. So they're well past that now. So, yes, they're putting themselves out again, and it's always weird, you know, when you put yourself on film and then you put it out to an audience because it's out there and you don't know how it's going to be responded to. But at the same time, I think they have an opportunity to inspire a larger, more productive conversation around our societal responsibility toward veterans, those who served but are injured by it in quiet, unseen ways. And I think as well they potentially have the opportunity to inspire a perhaps a more sensitive and enlightened political conversation. What we saw in the election last night was a large number of veterans on the Democratic side representing their districts in the House. And there's an opportunity to have a much more sophisticated conversation now, or at least begin to, that goes beyond the platitudes and the campaign slogan manipulation of veterans' issues and the kind of the political manipulation of and weaponizing of the troops.
Right.
And I think they have an opportunity to contribute that in a way that doesn't only work toward their own ends, but works toward the ends of veterans, the many thousands of veterans who are out there like them. And I think that they are desirous of that. So while this is a complicated process of, you know, of putting yourself on stage and then further putting yourself on a national stage, I think that as soldiers, as people who serve, who look out for one another as part of their ethos, I think what would be most gratifying for them is if they're being open allowed a greater openness for their colleagues out in our society who have not been to this point. And if they can reach out through this film and maybe help a few of them along the way, then I think, I think they'll be pleased with that.
You're good. That was great. In light of that, this documentary, We Are Not Done Yet, is premiering on HBO. As we sit and speak, I can say it's tomorrow, Thursday, November 8th, 9 o'clock.
8 o'clock.
8 o'clock, thank you. 7 o'clock Central. Yeah. And it's a great counterbalance, if you will. Well, first of all, Veterans Day is coming right up next Monday, I think, right?
We celebrate it. It's Sunday.
Sunday, excuse
me. But we celebrate it on Monday.
Yeah. Okay. And that we're sending troops down to the Mexican border, you know, is ludicrous.
It's insane.
It's insane.
So it's a dishonoring of the troops, and it's a weaponizing of the troops. And you know, when we're told that, you know, a conversation when NFL players are trying to start a conversation around police brutality by taking this gesture, when the national anthem plays, we're told that that's a disrespecting of the troops. But the troops didn't have anything to do with that conversation. That was about police brutality. Now we have a conversation around immigration that's being maligned by the manipulation of troops who are being inserted into a situation that they have nothing to do with. And what are we asking them to do? Are we asking them to go down and fire on women and children?
Mm-hmm.
Have they not had enough? You know, we've been at war for 2 decades now, and I think it's vulgar. I think it's just, it's so below the honorable nature of the men and women who serve our country. And our politicians, particularly at the highest level now, behave in such a way that's not deserving of spit shining these people's boots. And it's dangerous, it's wrong, and I'm glad to see that there are more veterans involved now on the Democratic side and on the Republican side, for that matter, who can speak firsthand about how ridiculous this type of manipulation, this type of rhetoric coming out of the White House is, and this use of our military. It's wrong, and everybody with any with two good eyes and a sensible brain can see that. I'm just pissed off about it.
I hear you, and I don't blame. I'm right there with you. We're so close to the surface of so much anger, and it's hard to channel that in a constructive. That's what, in a way, I'm glad that you said that, because making this documentary is a constructive way of channeling this anger.
I think the constructive thing about the documentary too is that we hear firsthand from these veterans a more nuanced and complicated perspective on who they are, on who the troops are, on who the vets are. We hear it from them as opposed to from the politicians and the blowhards, and they have an opportunity they have an opportunity to slice through this noise in a way that I think will be heard, because there's no arguing the authenticity of their voices. And while, you know, we may be living in a place in our society now where we're celebrating the authenticity of lies, I think that they, you know, they have an authenticity that's built on, you know, on certainly on personal truth and on what is fact. And so I look forward to their being able to share that perspective, particularly now with a larger American audience than just the audience that we had in that theater, that 500-seat theater down in D.C.
Jeffrey Wright, thank you. I appreciate it.
Cool. Thank you.
Thanks, man.
You must leave now. Take what you need. You think will last. But whatever you wish to keep, you better grab it fast. Yonder stands your orphan with his gun, crying like a fire.
Filmwax Radio is available on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play, and YouTube, of course. So please do subscribe and leave comments and follow everything, and let everybody know about that. And it's much appreciated. We're also available, of course, to engage with us through Facebook and Twitter, Instagram, of course. Please do subscribe. Okay, so thank you for that. Coming up on the show, the next episode, I think I'm going to try it. I've been meaning to put this up for ages now. My returning friend Amos Poe is back on the show. So I'm just going to put that up, I believe, on Monday's episode, the special episode, so I can keep up with some of these shows that are, I'm so proud of, and the types of conversations that I'm having. I think this one especially is very germane. It's what I had with Amos, and where we talk mostly about, you know, well, I'm not going to go into it. We talked about more things than just film in this particular conversation, but it'll be coming right up. Longtime friend Hal Hartley, who has been on the show, like 3 or 4 times now, will be back yet again. The box set for his Long Island trilogy, The Unbelievable Truth, Trust, and Simple Men, finally is coming out later this month. It will be available and for purchase and just in time for Black Friday. Anyway, we will have Hal back on the show with special guests. Okay, now I leaked one out the other day on Twitter. through our Film Wax Radio Twitter account. So go look at that if you're interested in knowing. I dropped one name of a bunch. Let's just say this. If you're a fan of independent films, you're going to have a great time in the coming couple of weeks as I release not only a show dedicated to the Long Island Trilogy, but all of these conversations on their own. So it's going to be a fun Thanksgiving period of time. Over your tryptophan crash, you can listen to the podcast and enjoy that. So there you go. So what did we learn today on the show? Stream at least a few times the Orson Welles film, The Other Side of the Wind. Watch the documentary, Morgan Neville's documentary, produced by Josh Karp, called They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, which is the making of The Other Side of the Wind. So you learned that. You learned that you should pick up a copy of Josh Karp's book called Orson Welles' Last Movie, the making of The Other Side of the Wind. So you should get that. And you also learned you should watch the documentary We Are Not Done Yet on HBO. And while you're on HBO, we'll catch up with episodes of Westworld, right? Anyway, yeah, that's a lot of stuff to learn. Okay, guys, I guess that's it for episode 519. As I mentioned, we'll be back in a few days with a brand new episode with Amos Poe, and then back next Thursday, our regular scheduled show, which I guess will be 521, yeah, with I guess maybe, I don't know, I have two episodes I could put up, one of two episodes. So I don't know, maybe if you're listening at this point and you tweet to me whether you would want the conversation with Austin Pendleton or the conversation with Peter Riegert, two great actors, you'll let me know. I'll post one of those two next Thursday. That'll be the plan on the 15th of November. All right, this is your host, Adam Shartoff of FilmWax Radio, wishing you well. Take care of yourself and the ones you love. Broken lines, broken strings, broken threads, broken springs, broken idols, broken heads. With broken hearts, broken words, never meant to be spoken.